a dream that we'd all die for. A reason for us all to live and something we could fight for. I might just help a man up to his feet or hold a newborn, but no matter what I do, my hands remembering my rifle.
They are to Wattstraps what Sean Connery is to James Bond. What do I mean by that? I mean that they are distinguished. I mean that they charm not just the ladies. Everyone gets charmed by Sean Connery, don't they? Same with the Zulu Alpha strap. If you've got a watch, you want something that's robust. You want something that is stylish to hold it onto your wrist. You don't want something that's going to be snapping and losing your expensive timepiece. And, as we've always said, if you have an awful timepiece, you don't want people looking at it. So you want them looking at the strap instead. So, no matter how much you spent on your watch, or how Gucci it is, or how whatever the opposite of that is, I can't even think at the moment, rats, maybe, for the bootnecks. Get yourself a Zulu Alpha strap. You'll be supporting a veteran-owned, veteran-operated company who supports not only podcasts like this, they've also been doing some stuff recently supporting good causes like the Ukraine. I mean, to be honest, I think there was a bit jack of them giving that money to refugees instead of giving it the podcast, but not my decision. We'll speak about that in person, Daz. but no, they are a great, great team over there, doing a lot to support veterans, doing a lot for the veteran community, which was, as we've always said, is obviously a strong community because there's a lot of support going on out there. So you can do your part in it by checking them out, Zulu Alpha Straps. You want a nice, like, but you know, joking apart, guys, we'd all like to be going out and buying nice watches for the people who mean a lot in our lives. But to be fair, costs a lot of money, don't they? Zulu Alpha Straps don't cost a lot of money and they're lovely. And then you can work towards getting the nice bit of watch to go on the end. You can get a nice watch to go on it in a few years when you're earning a bit more bank. But for now, just get them the watch strap. Zulu Alpha Straps, at Zulu Alpha Straps on social media, ZuluAlphaStraps.com. Linked up down in the show notes. Go and support them. Great bunch, great team, Combat Fuel. You know by now that they sponsor the podcast. They sponsor not just my Juicy Gains, but Juicy Gains of many of the listeners. In fact, a few of the people involved with Combat Fuel were actually on the same PTI course as me, so you know that they are Turbo Essence. On the subject of Turbo Essence, I had a little care package from Combat Fuel today, and I had in there what is one of my favourite flavours, which, to be honest, I don't even want to shout out because I don't want it getting bought out. White chocolate flavour whey. I mix it with milk. Absolutely delicious. But we are getting closer to summer, so I've got to start thinking about calories. So I've got from them some cola-flavoured clear whey. What is clear whey? I don't know how it works. It's hocus pocus. I really have no idea. It tastes like cola. You mix it with water. It tastes like those cola bottle sweets you get. It's really nice, and it's whey protein. Like I said, I don't know how it works. I'm not Dr. Fauci. I don't know science. All I know is Juicy Gains. It works. It's delicious. And they also sent me cod liver oil, multivitamins. What else did we have in there? Zinc, magnesium. You need those. Why? Because you get strong immune system. Then you don't need Dr. Fauci in your life because you've got a strong immune system going on. And also, you get a nice morning glory going on with the old zinc. You might get that anyway. I know we got a lot of young people, but those of us who are getting on in age, we need all the help we can get. So get a bit of the old zinc magnesium down here. Check them out at Combat Fuel. You know the score by now, at Combat Fuel, Combat-Fuel, linked up in the show notes. That's the thing. If you go and click on whatever you're listening on right now, you can see there's links to everything. We've got them on social media. Sticking in the old DuckDuckGo. Don't promote Google anymore. Don't do Google searches. We do DuckDuckGo searches. Stick Combat Fuel in there. Get your Juicy Gains on. And if you use the code, this is a bit I always forget, use the code VSOM, you get some money off. And also, they know what we sent you. So you win, I win, they win, everyone wins. And yes, get to them now. All right, come on. Welcome to Veteran State of Mind. I'm Geraint Jones, and I am joined today by Brian. Brian, how are you doing, mate?
I'm good, sir. I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for giving up your time, mate. Appreciate it. Been looking forward to doing this for a while, but I know you have been a busy man. Before we get into your latest trip, can you just give everybody who doesn't know you from your work and social media, just give them a bit of an insight into who you are?
Yeah. Well, I grew up just west of London in a town called Beaconsfield, and then moved to London a good 20 years ago. Got into photography. Originally trained as a chef, then got into photography. And then it was during my time as a photographer I just sort of wanted to test myself. So I was around about 35 when I joined the reserves. I did a lot of stuff with in the army, and then did a tour of Afghanistan, which then led to quite a well-known exhibition called The Best View of Heaven is from Hell. And then from that point, I then traveled a lot with photography. I went to Iraq. I actually went back to Afghanistan. And it was on my second trip that I came up with the idea of using AK-47s in my sculpture work. And then I got back, and that was about 2012. And since then, I've just sort of slowly moved into the art world, and it's sort of snowballed from there, really.
There's a lot of interesting things in there. I mean, the military at 35 is a really interesting one.
I had to dig deep.
We'll come into that later, mate. But I want to talk about your most recent trip. Because I know we probably have a lot of fighters who are going to be familiar with, listeners who are familiar with this. Could you tell everyone a bit about your recent trip and who you were kind of working working out in Vegas before?
Yeah. So going back to about 2017. Someone told me that Dana White had bought one of my artworks. So I went, I was out there working with some other clients, and I just popped by the UFC office. I buzzed him an email, and then we had lunch, and I talked him through the artwork he owned in his office. His office is a very famous office. He's got a lot of cool stuff in there, from samurai swords to saber-tooth tiger skull. And then we were just having a beer, shooting the shit. And he then commissioned me to make him one for his house, which was $100 bills, covered in $100 bills. And so I use real dollar bills on my artwork. So I kind of laughed and went, well, if you supply the Franklin dollars, I'll happily make it. So we agreed on a price, and then... And then COVID struck, and then I got really busy. And then, so I went out there, my first window of opportunity, and made in the artwork in Vegas, which was quite a, if anyone knows Vegas, it can be a bit cheeky.
That's an understatement.
So so I had a lot of fun out there, but then I had to then move slightly 25, 30 minutes from the main strip, and I rented a house out. So I had some peace and quiet. And just stayed there with the fiance and made the artwork. But then subsequently, other clients heard I was in the States and then started requesting works as well. So a 2-week trip ended up being 2 months.
Busy 2 months.
Yeah, really busy. I totally bit off more than I could chew. And then I spent a good couple of weeks on this art piece because I really wanted to make it one of the best I've done so far. And when you're taking a scalpel to $100 bills, it does sort of change perspective on cash because you realize it is just paper. And then subsequently, because I've sort of moved into the NFT world and cryptocurrency, it's sort of, it was quite ironic that I was cutting up real money.
Sorry to interrupt, but I think we do have a lot of infantry listening. So can we explain to them what an NFT is? Sorry to put you on the spot.
No. It's called a non-fungible token. Basically, every day is a school day with this because it changes. I mean, rewind a few months, I didn't know anything about it. But it's basically, it's artwork, but in its digital format. So imagine buying something in a digital way. And then because an NFT, it's on the blockchain, which it has a coding to it. So each thing that you buy on the blockchain is completely unique to that. So you could make anything into an NFT. It could be a photo of your grandma, or it could be an art piece, or it could be music. And there was a massive explosion in the NFT world last year. A lot of people know about them, but hardly any people are actually involved in buying them. That will change because you can only buy them now if you own Ethereum or certain cryptocurrencies. So you have to have a MetaMask wallet. But I think they're changing that now. But yeah, I mean, it's a deep world, and it's crazy. It's a crazy world because you've got like the Bored Ape Club. You've got these pictures of apes exchanging for hundreds of thousands of pounds. I mean, it's a bit of a head fuck, to be honest with you.
It's a big time. Like I I understand the principle of it and stuff, and but then you look at some of the numbers, I'm like, why are people doing this? But then, you know, you mentioned Vegas. Well, why are people spending $100,000 for a night, you know, on champagne sprays? Well, to brag.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ego involved, I think. Especially, I've noticed probably in the last sort of 5 to 6 years, the disparity of wealth has gone huge.
Mm.
And people are just throwing money at things, you know. I mean, look at Rolex watches, for instance. You know, you can't even buy one at the moment because just the prices are going crazy. And it's the same in the NFT world. You know, there's a lot of NFTs you can buy for next to nothing, but sort of the top tier ones are going for lots of money. I think people are just seeing it as an investable stuff. But that's not what all NFTs are about. It is actually about just making art and putting it in a digital format. But I think because of how unique NFTs are with their coding, I think it will move over to because I was talking to Dana about this, about making UFC tickets NFTs. So they're all individual, you know, like flight tickets for your airfare, you know, for your flight and stuff.
I'm really interested in NFTs, mate, because, like you said, I mean, we're still really, really super early days on it. But, you know, you work in, you know, the arts. I work in the arts. We both know how much people will pay for a signed copy of a first edition or something. And I just think, like, you know, it's like people love collectibles. And, you know, the blockchain is a really interesting way of doing it.
No, absolutely.
I think it's an exciting time to be an artist, I think, mate, because a lot of this stuff, I think, you know, I think at first there was a lot of artists I know in music and stuff who were really excited about this because they thought NFTs would be an opportunity to get music to the more kind of like the grassroots artists rather than the few DJs, musicians who were getting paid a lot of money. And I think it has got distorted a little bit, but I think, you know, because like you said, there's a lot of ego involved. So people are just coming out and buying like ridiculous, people coming out and buying insane prices for, say, a Steve Aoki NFT when that, you know, which has been made for someone else and he has, you know, hasn't even touched, you know, his hand and stuff. Not that I'm slagging him off, I'm just using him as an example. I'm sure there's plenty of other people, you know, doing the same. But it is something that I think everybody should spend a little time kind of looking into, and it is hard to wrap your head around. And I'm not saying I got my head around it, you know, fully at all, but definitely enough to see that there's some really, you know, exciting opportunities here. So to get back around then to what you're saying, mate, so you were out in, out in the States.
Yeah. So I set myself up in Vegas to make the art piece because bringing deactivated AK-47s into the States can be problematic, which I learned the hard way when some of my works got banned a few years back coming into Texas. So I decided to buy the AK-47 out there from a company called Rifle Dynamics, and they actually specialize in solely making AK-47s for people in America to shoot. So they were a little bit perplexed when I went in there and said, right, I want to buy a really lovely AK-47 from you, but I don't want it to fire any rounds. So it cocked, it dry fired, and so they created this AK-47 for me, and then I started working on it, which is quite a long process. And then I presented it to Dana, probably over a month ago now, and he absolutely loved it. I took it to the UFC office, and he scoped about it, and then he ended up posting about it as well, which was quite good because it sort of threw quite a few people my way.
Is that how you get most of your work? Is it word of mouth?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say that. I mean, obviously, my gallery does a lot as well. They're situated in London, and then they have art fairs in like Miami, LA and stuff, so that sort of helps project my work. I find a lot of my work is bought when people physically see it, and then social media has taken on a more powerful role as well. So when I started first posting stuff on Instagram a few years back, it was just me out pissed with a few mates, but now it's very professional, you know, and it's all about my work and behind the scenes and stuff. But I've got my fiance to thank for that because she's the one that makes me look cool.
Well, I mean, the pieces do look—they look amazing on social media, which is, you know, some art doesn't really translate to social media, if you know what I mean. I don't know if it's the colors in them, because they're, you know, I suppose if you've got like this big a big painting or something. There's so much going on when it's shrank down to kind of like fitting a little window on Instagram, it doesn't really fit. But
no, sure.
And I think, you know, maybe because people are familiar with the shape of what you're doing, it draws the eye because you know the shape, and then it's a different take on it. So it's kind of like, you know what I mean? It's like that.
I mean, that's kind of partly why I was working on AK-47 to begin with, because it is the shape that is so symbolic. The shape of an AK-47 is instantly recognizable, and that's something that I've played within my artwork.
So how do you come up with an idea? Because I'm always really interested in knowing where ideas come from, right? So do you work on ideas? Do you wake up with ideas? Do you maybe go to a special place and do a special thing to get ideas? You know, like, where do they come from?
I have a bucket of ideas. No. I don't know. It's an interesting question, actually. I mean, I find I get inspired by a lot of things, but they're not necessarily linked to what I do. So, you know, I might go out into the countryside, go for a ride on my motorbike or something, you know, and just get some headspace. Or I'll be walking around the streets of East London where I live and I'll see something. And then quite a lot of the time I'll probably cross over things. I'll take something from there and I'll take something from there and then create something in my head. And then I think a lot of my artworks do look at civil rights and the environmental issues that are going on. And how conflict has caused issues around the world. So then that's always the backbone of the narrative of my artwork. So then I sort of look at that as well. You know, so sometimes you have a light bulb moment where you just go, oh, fuck, you know, but you've got to be idea storming to begin with, I find.
And what about when you come to execute an idea like, say the Dana White project, for instance? When you've had the idea on that, then are you like, no, I know it's a good idea, I've just got to follow through, trust the process and all that stuff? Or is it like, do you get the doubts? Are you like, oh, fucking hell, is this the right idea? Should I be doing, you know, should I start again?
I mean, I'm kind of like that. Well, once I've got a firm vision, that's what I'm going for. But whether it be anything, if it's something in life I want, or I'm making artwork, or I'm photographing something. But what you have to do in the process is learn from the mistakes you're making within that process and then slightly steer around them and learn from them. And I find that a lot of mistakes become happy mistakes, and you're like, well, I didn't mean to do that, but I'm actually happy with that. And I think it's just having the confidence within yourself to sort of go, yeah, I'm happy with this. And at the end of the day, I was taught a while ago that when you're making art, or when you're photographing anything or creating anything, you've got to do what turns you on. You can't be trying to please everyone else all the time. And with that, you know, you get flack for it because someone might not like it, but you're like, well, I don't care, I like it.
Mate, 100%. Like I always say, like with writing, it's like, write what you want to read. And then if no one ever buys it, no one ever reads it, well, who cares? You enjoyed it, which, don't get me wrong, doesn't put the food on the table, but that shouldn't be your first priority, you know, anyway.
No, exactly. I mean, I got lucky where I was creating artwork which people wanted physically in their own homes. And there's been a few times and I've tried to adjust certain things and thought, you know, oh, that could be a crowd pleaser. A lot of people will like that. And it always ends up being the stuff that doesn't actually sell. It's a strange thing. So I think it's very important to stick to what you know. I mean, obviously you can take advice and you can listen to people, you know, how something's displayed or a direction. I mean, there's so many people are coming to me and going, oh, why don't you do this? Why don't you try that? You know, and I'll always listen to them and jot the ideas down, but then I might take something from that and then apply it to something else, you know? So I think it's always good to listen to people. You can't be bloody minded about your own work. But the biggest lesson, I mean, in life as well, but creating artwork, is to learn from your mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. And like, all criticism isn't created equally. You know, some people, I always think, like, you know, I say, I mean, this is again just in life. It's like, who are you taking criticism for? Is it or from? You know, kind of look at someone's position in life and go, well, okay, that person's tanking my thing. Well, are they at a point where, You know, are they successful in their own field? Are they successful in arts? Like, what have they done that makes me think, like, right, this is an opinion worth listening to? And they'll be right a lot of the time, you know, and those are the people you listen to.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And one thing I've learned over the last few years as well is that you'll find people that are successful in a known field and are doing well, they'll never really have a negative perspective about what you're doing. They will just tell you straight and give you advice. It always tends to be the people that put your stuff down that aren't doing shit themselves. And at the end of the day, you know, you've always got to say to yourself, opinions are like arseholes. Everyone's got one, right?
Exactly. And I was actually talking about this on social media recently, because one of the things I enjoy doing is reading Amazon reviews, because you'll get one that's like a glowing 5-star, and then the next one will be, this is shit. But I always think, well, that's where you want it. You want ones and you want fives.
Yeah, no, totally.
If you're just getting threes in the middle, it means you're never doing anything that's going to make someone's day, or it's going to change the way someone thinks, or, you know, no one's going to be excited about having a piece of art that's a three up on the wall, are they?
Yeah, I mean, with this NFT collection I did was all my AK-47 artwork, where I took actual photographs of my art pieces and then embellished them. And then I took different models of AK-47s that I photographed all myself with optic sights, laser sights, different mag changes. And then I embellished those. And, you know, and everyone had opinions about those. But I said to myself, well, whether someone likes it or not, I'm going to just do it to the best of my quality. You know, I'm going to be proud every time I see one of those. And at the end of the day, that's what you need, you know. I mean, part of the regimental ethos was the constant pursuit of excellence. And I remember my commander saying, that's great, because everything you do will be to your spec, but you'll never really be totally happy, because you're always trying to do better. So every time I start a job, I always think, right, I want to try and make this art piece better than the last one.
That's a great point, though, isn't it? Is to think that everything comes at a price, doesn't it? So if you have that mindset of, you know, I'm always going to do better, then there's never going to be that point where you're like, oh yeah, I'm totally satisfied with my work and things. There's always, but it's keeping that hunger in a positive way rather than letting it become a negative thing.
Yeah, no, totally. And you know, the more I've grown as an artist and I'm getting more out there and connecting with different people, you know, you learn very quickly that there's a lot of people out there that will talk a lot of shit about you, or they'll try and pull the rug from under your feet. But you've just got to maintain a self-belief and a strength, and just crack on with what you believe in.
It's crazy, because the people who actually probably have the least amount of time to give, because they're so like busy, because they're successful in their own lives, I find are the ones who are actually the most generous with their time.
They are, because I think, you know, it's probably now that I look back on my last few years, you know, I was sofa surfing, I was like, you know, not knowing where my next money was going to come from. Sometimes it was bleak, you know, and it really was blood, sweat and tears. And I just sort of was like, no, this is what I'm going to stick to, you know? And when you look back on that, I think now I look at other artists and people that have been successful, even if I never really had much an opinion of them or I rated them that much, but I still look at them and go, well, fair play, mate. You know, you battled through it and you're still there doing it, you know, and that alone is worth respect.
I mean, are you even an artist if you didn't sofa surf and go hungry for a bit? No, you know, you got to have a bit
yeah,
of that.
Exactly.
But that is where you have to really stick to your vision and not start to chase a check.
Totally. You know, and I think as well, people have this perception that everything happens immediately. You know, if they hear about an artist, yeah. I mean, I do it myself. If someone goes, oh, have you heard about this artist? And I look at them and go, oh man, you know, they're doing really well. And how did they do that? And, you know, someone once said it takes 10 years to become an overnight success. And I'm really starting to believe that now, you know. It's there's so much involved, and you know, the thing as well is there's a misconception about being an artist and owning your own business or being self-employed, because it's one of the same thing. You know, you're dealing with bills, you're trying to manage your money, you're trying to manage cash flow, you're buying materials, you're selling materials. So it's the same stresses, really.
Yeah.
And like in any business, you have people criticizing it. You have people that might do a bad job for you, so you've got to redo it. You've got competition. Do you know what I mean? So it's the same vibe.
Mate, when it comes to the people buying your work, obviously you have a bit of a on with the AKs and stuff. It's obviously like that kind of, you know, not everyone is as big of a fan of weapons as the people in the military are. You know, some people see them as quite a, you know, they see them as quite a scary thing.
No, totally. Yeah.
Where are your customers? Are they, you know, what is the kind of like? I mean, obviously, I'm sure it is a wide group of people. But where do you find the kind of, if you could like generalize the backgrounds of a lot of your buyers?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you touched on that, because that is an issue that I often come against. Like on an art fair, or if someone comes into the gallery in Mayfair and sees my artwork, one of the first things they'll say is, "Oh, I love it, but I'm not into guns," you know, and then they have to be told the narrative and the my viewpoints on weapons and conflict, because there's layers to the art pieces, from what's on the weapon to what I filled the bullets with the symbolic fillings and the commodities. But I find generally the people that buy my artwork is right across the board. You know, it could be businessmen, women that are very successful, art collectors. You know, I think the King of Bahrain bought one through an art fair. So it's all over the place. But a lot of ex-military guys do buy my work, and some of the prints as well. And I have to say, I get more pride from selling my work to them than I do these high-end art collectors, in a way.
Yeah, mate, I totally understand that. I mean, there's always something rewarding about getting the pat on the back from your own tribe.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll always try and look out for them as well, whether it's a discount or I'll throw something else in there, you know. And it's a good buzz that I get from that. I've got quite a lot of people that have bought my work, but based down in Poole and Hereford and some up north as well. So it's it's good. It's good.
As an artist, are you a collector yourself of other people's work?
Yeah, I mean, I keep meaning to collect more artwork because I'm in a good position to do that. But it's I've got a few bits scattered around my place. I wish I had more. But yeah, it's a case of just sort of time and commitment, really. But I do collect artwork. Being an artist, they say, you know, you've got to be quite narcissistic, but I actually hate that. But I have art pieces that I like and sort of create, you know, the sort of expressive, or they sort of create sort of a buzz for me, you know.
Like the stuff you do, I love that kind of end of art, that really kind of, I don't know how, it just looks so crisp and just vibrant, but at the same time, just fucking cool. But then on the other end of the spectrum, I love a good old fucking painting of a Lancaster bomber, you know? So those are the two things I kind of like. I mean, I love that. I've got the ones with, you know, signed by the crew members and stuff. And I mean, those things.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
amazing. They mean a lot to me, those things. But like, you know, I do have some pieces as well. I like to get stuff from people who are veterans or have been in that kind of world as well. Because I think when we're all older and we'll be looking back, it'll be like, how cool is it that we've got all these things from all these different veterans that went on and did great things?
Yeah. Rather than going for a known artist and buying that, I do tend to sort of buy bits and pieces that I do like, you know, like you were just saying. I mean, I've got a shelf. I collect quite a lot of trench art from the First World War.
Mm.
You know, where they made things in the trenches and after the First World War with the empty cases and stuff. You know, and I've got some bits and pieces that I brought back from Afghanistan. So I sort of see that as art as well. It doesn't have to be in a frame hanging on a wall. You know, it's just stuff that creates a memory or an experience, you know. But But I do actually have art pieces that are just like a beautiful photograph in a frame sort of thing.
With your own photography, where did you think you get that, like, kind of that desire to capture the, you know, capture photos?
I think it was just from a childhood, because I was dyslexic, so I wasn't much of a reader, so I was more visual. So I'd read a lot of comic books and look through magazines and stuff, and then I just got quite fascinated with the layout of photographs and the composition, and then it kind of sort of tied in with me wanting to go away a lot more and do a lot of travel and see a bit of the world. So obviously, when you find yourself somewhere like Africa, you're having all these amazing things presented to you that you want to capture, and then I think as that carried on, you sort of want to hone your skills a lot more, you know, and then sort of there's one thing doing something as a hobby, and there's another thing doing it professionally, because when you do anything professionally, then that comes with all the headaches and everything, you know. So but that's what I pursued, and ended up doing for quite a few years.
Was it that you wanted to go to these places and then you were like, and I want to get the photos? Or was it like, I want to go to these places to get the photos?
It started out, I want to go to these places, oh, and I'll get some photos, and then it turned into, I want to go to these places to get the photos, for sure. Yeah.
And is that something, do you keep the photography up now while you, when you travel?
I mean, obviously the last 2 years have been put on ice, but I did. I mean, I've kind of rested the camera a bit. I mean, I used to run around taking pictures of fucking everything, and then it would go into the black hole of the hard drive and never to be seen again. And I literally had about 20 years of photography that sadly went up in flames about a year and a half ago.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, my storage unit got burned down. So that kind of put me off taking pictures for a little bit. But with my recent trip, I'm sort of being kind of inspired to shoot again. But I've got a trip doing this anti-poaching project in Africa. So that will definitely be an opportunity for me to pick up the camera and take some portraits again. I would say portraiture is the one thing that I do miss doing. For instance, when I was in Afghanistan, I would try and take some portraits of the Afghan National Police that I was working with, and then in Africa it would be sort of like local tribesmen and stuff. But I try and take things that sort of tell a bit of a story, you know, so sort of if they're in interesting surroundings, I try and capture that as well.
Mate, Vegas must have had some good opportunity. I fucking love, I love looking at people in Vegas.
Oh yeah, I mean, I didn't take many pictures in Vegas, but I did a lot of people watching, you know, a lot of like, when there's a drunk fat Elvis stumbling down the road, you just can't help but take this. But yeah, but it was good. I would like to go back. You can have some great street photography there, for sure.
I love it, because you've got like 1 minute you can just, because I love just going to sit in. So I got, because some of the casinos are more upmarket than others, right?
Yeah.
So I like to go and sit in the ones where it's like, you know, kind of bargain basement prices, and just go and sit in there, get a drink and watch what's going in there. And then you can go across the road to a place where someone's just paid 200 grand to have fucking champagne sprayed all over the fucking room. I mean, I'm just, I love yeah, how opposite like the things are there, but it all revolves around money. And it's just, it's just so fucking fascinating. Such a fascinating place.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is a weird place. I mean, like, the first couple of times I went, I was just like, oh, I don't feel this, but the last few times I've been, you have to accept it for what it is. And yeah, it is a pretty mad place. I mean, it is very money oriented. But like you said, you know, if you go downtown, then you hit up these cheap sort of old school casinos, which I prefer. And then you go to the sort of more posher, well-known ones, like the Bellagio and stuff. And then you get a different side of it. But yeah, I mean, just the people and the shapes and sizes. And you've got these people with cigarettes hanging out of their mouth going around in those mobility scooters. And it's just like, what has humanity come to? Do you know what I mean? It's like, I had a good time there, but I ain't going to lie, it was good to leave. But if you ever go back, I tell you, a place to visit is Boulder City. It's a town east of Vegas, because I've got a friend that runs a range out there called Pro Gun. So I went there quite a few times to put some rounds down and take some photos. And just by there, there's a town called Boulder City, which is it was created to make Hoover Dam, which is just up the road. And it's quite a well-known biker town. A lot of biker gangs used to go through it, but then they banned that. It's a really cool vibe there. It's really old school. You should definitely go there. It's about a 30-minute drive from the Strip.
I think I'll be passing through. I'm going out there. Where am I? The middle of May. I'm out there for a bit. Yeah. I've got a lot of friends that are conveniently living there now. So got a good excuse to go.
A lot of people have gone there. I mean, I was surprised how many friends I had in town as well. Like, so a lot of people from LA have moved there. But I'll hook you up with my mate Mark Eastman. He runs Pro Gun, and he's amazing, and he'll take you on a few shoots there.
Man, I'd love to get some. It's been fucking. God, I don't know when it was, but I know when it was. Last time I did put rounds down was last time I was in the States, so over 2 years ago now.
Same.
So it's how did you find that? How did you find getting back on a weapon after so long? Does it kind of just all come back?
Well, I mean, it all comes back. I mean, sort of, it weren't really some of the weapon systems we were using, because I make art with AK-47, so I wanted to mainly fire those, but there's always that first 10 seconds of holding a live weapon going, oh yeah, I can actually just turn this and slot you and that's it, sort of thing. So you have to kind of remind, you have to sort of just quickly remind yourself of the responsibility, and then obviously all the range rules and stuff. But I really enjoy it, you know. And we did these like fire and maneuver things where we were sort of jumping off a truck, putting rounds down, and then shooting through windows and stuff on the range that Mark arranged. And I ain't gonna lie, it got the adrenaline up. I really enjoyed it, and it sort of took me back a little bit.
Yeah, I really enjoy it too, mate. And I think when I'm doing it as well, it makes me appreciate how well we were instructed in the British military.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. Because even that day that I'm talking about, I was on the range, my mate Mark ended up booting this guy off because he had one in the chamber. And you're very aware of where your fingers are, your safety's on. But you're right, it is ingrained in you. And it's kind of almost nice. It's nice when that training comes back and you're aware of it, and it sort of makes you sort of respect the guys that taught you in the first place.
Yeah, very much so, mate. When you were out in Vegas, did you get a chance to go into the, you know, out in the kind of mountains and stuff? Because, like, there's some fucking insane scenery.
So where I was in an area called Enterprise. It's literally 20 minutes, 15 minutes from the Strip. And you're right at the base of a lot of the mountains. And I would look at them every day going, I need to get my boots up there. And I didn't, because I was just busy every day. And I actually left Vegas really frustrated. And one of my mates who lives there, he's in the American military, and he was telling me about all these routes and stuff to do next time we go. So every time I've been in Vegas, I've kind of been working, whether it's been photographic jobs or making art. So I definitely want to go back probably this year and just have a week of getting out in the mountains and just doing some fun stuff.
You probably like that. I think it's called Red Rocks Canyon, where they've got the hieroglyphs and stuff. Is hieroglyphs the right word? Like, they've got the ancient Native American, but like,
yes.
We're talking like thousands of years ago. I've never got out to those. I've been out into some of the mountain areas and stuff there, but I've never been to Red Rocks, hopefully this year.
But also, you're so close to Grand Canyon as well. I mean, yeah. It is a mad part of the world. And you can't help but when you're driving around and you've got all these structures going up and around you, you can't help but think, you know, what was it like when these guys were coming through here on horseback with nothing here? You know, it must have been nuts.
Mate, I've done that drive from LA to Vegas a lot of times, and it's just like a lot of it is just nothingness, and you got like Barstow on the way, and there's that, I think there's Barstow, and then there's that place with the massive thermometer and shit. But like, you go in from nothing for hours.
Yeah.
And like, the scale of America, I think, is just... Especially like that, because if you go to LA, it like everything's so built up and stuff. Not in the same way as like say London is, but it's still very built up. So you don't like it. Just doesn't feel that different to like being in the UK. But when you get out into that middle part of America, you're like, holy fuck, this is a totally different ballgame.
No, totally. And you always make that schoolboy error as well, that rookie error. But when you're looking at Google Maps, you're like, oh, that's just around the corner, and then you start walking there, and you're like, hang on a minute, this is 10 kilometers away, do you know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, I've done that drive from LA to Vegas, and it's like a 4-hour drive or something, isn't it?
If you're all right with the traffic, it's about 4 hours. And if you hit traffic bad, it could be like if there's been a festival on the weekend and everyone's going back to California, then it can be a lot more
a bit moody.
Yeah, I'm always a fan of like, let's, this, the great thing about being a self-employed artist, you're like, well, I don't have work to get back to, I'll stay here the extra day.
Yeah. I'll stay at the bar. Yeah.
Mate, let's talk a bit more about the military then, because I could talk about the artist side of things all day, but I know a lot of people tune into this for the pew 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 stuff. So how did you get around to the decision to join the military then?
Well, like I said, I was working in photography in London, and in all honesty, I just sort of was doing a lot of fashion at the time, and just felt it was just a bit of a vacuous industry, and just got to a point in my life where I hadn't sort of tested myself, and I think joining the military was a scratch that I hadn't itched previously in my 20s. So I just thought I'd give it a go. And then I went to an open day at the then Chelsea Barracks, which isn't there now, in London, and just saw all the different stands, you know, and went up to one of them. I think it was the Green Jackets or something. And just started filling in the forms, and they said, oh, I was 34 at the time, and they were like, oh, you know, you're too old, mate. And I was really eager to join, and then they were, so I was a bit pissed off about that, and then I got a tap on the shoulder, and some guy just said, well, why don't you come and talk to these guys, they might take you on, they're desperate. And that's how I got in. Well, I mean, obviously it wasn't just one sign on the dotted line, because there was about a year and a half of selection process after that.
So that was because they had an upper age limit for what? Because it was an SF program?
Yeah, well, I don't even know if it was an upper age limit. They just said, well, you've got one shot at it. If you turn 35, you can't do it. But obviously, through the process, I turned 35, so officially I was 34 when I signed on the dotted line. But the option of failure wasn't really there, because I couldn't then reapply. It might have changed by now. I don't know. It probably has.
I don't know what the UKSF one is, but I know I'm pretty sure certain that the reserves massively up the age limit, because when they did the last, you know, round of cuts and stuff, they said that they were going to make up the numbers through the reserves, didn't they? And then they realised that anyone that wanted to join the reserves had already joined the reserves, and they didn't actually have anyone else to recruit. So they, I think they whacked the age up.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. Number making.
And I think it's, you know, in this day and age, mate, like I get it, back in the day, you know, a lot of people would be, you know, they're fucking physically burnt out by the time they got to the mid-30s because of working manual jobs and stuff. But now, you know, you can have a very intact body by the time you're still in your late 40s.
No, absolutely. And I think as well, pre-Iraq and Afghanistan, the reserves or the TA, they were seen as like these, you know, knobheads that were kind of weekend warriors that didn't really do much. And then I think after two tours of Iraq and Afghanistan, they realized that the reserves actually fulfilled probably 40 to 50% of the roles that were going on out there.
Yeah, I mean, I come from that myself, you know, and I've always thought there was definitely, for me, like two trains of kind of people that went through there. There was people that were like, I want to use this as a stepping thing to get to operations. And then there was the other side, which was like, I want this as my social club on the weekends. And, you know, and they can get some stick, but at the end of the day, you know, without them, there wouldn't have been the UK structure to get everyone else through the pipeline. So as much as I got to be honest, I don't understand someone that's in uniform and doesn't want to get on operations. It just doesn't make sense to me. You know, they are probably necessary to get people through, and, you know, so it does take all kinds.
I think, I'll be honest, I think when I first applied, I was just doing it to see if I could do it. My idea of going on operations wasn't there, but then someone said, well, once you train up, you'll want to do it. And I was like, nah, I won't want to do it. And then I trained up and I was like, yeah, I want to do it now. You know, I want to get out there and get amongst the sand, you know.
Was that because you'd made mates who were going and you kind of didn't want to, you know, was it that kind of like, well, I don't want to, you know, not go out with these lads that I've just gone through all this experience with?
Yeah, no, there was a lot of that, obviously. And then I think there was just a sort of probably a self-pride, you know, I can't train for a few years and then not do what I've been trained to do, you know. So it sort of seemed a bit stupid after a while.
Do you keep up that side of, you know, like that physical side of your life? Because obviously when you're going through that selection, I mean, you know, it's I mean, we don't need, people know it's obviously very rigorously demanding, very physically demanding. Is that part of your life now? Do you kind of build that into what your life looks like?
I would love to say yes every day, mate. But I think the only rigorous thing I do at the moment is grab a bottle of rum off the shelf.
I can get your heart going.
Yeah. No. I mean, for years I was and did, but I saw my fizz slacked last year just purely because of so much work and then travel. But I'm definitely back on getting on board because I just sort of find my mental state and my health state is suffering. And I do miss that side of things, you know, pushing yourself to those limits and stuff. But again, it's sort of, I always get envious when I see my mates I serve with or other friends, you know, and they're running up and down the hills and stuff. And, I, you know, being in London, you kind of miss that sort of outdoorsness. But I'm definitely back on track now to start training again because I think it's good fuel for the mind.
Oh, mate, 100%. I think, to be honest, mate, I think I do it more for the mental side of things now than the physical side.
Yeah, I think a lot of guys do.
Yeah, I mean, they go hand in hand. But I think if you had to say to me, like, which one do you think benefits more, then really it's the, you know, it's in the head of that. Obviously we won't go into talk about in detail what you did on deployment, but could you say about how it maybe changed the way that you looked at the world, looked at yourself, you know, those kind of questions?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, even the training and then the lead up to going away, you know, the pre-deployment training, it certainly changed my mindset and how I was, you know, that silly side of me got pushed out, which I think is probably more of a self-centered and selfish side of you. I think when you join the military, you learn to work as a team and you take certain issues with a pinch of salt because you know there's bigger things at play. Certainly when I was in Afghanistan, it taught me a lot the hard way, you know, camaraderie is always the first thing that comes to the front of my mind, you know, and having guys around you that you could rely on, and you wanted them to rely on you, taught me a lot. And I think, and then we sadly lost four guys who happened to be mates of mine on the same patrols, two separate incidents. One of them was well known, documented, because Sarah Bryant was within the vehicle. It was the first woman to get killed in Afghanistan. They drove over an IED, which frustratingly, we were in those dated snatches that they brought over from Northern Ireland, you know, the Land Rovers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That just weren't suitable or armoured in the correct manner. And that got flipped over and all the guys instantly died. And then one of my other mates in a firefight, he knelt on a device near Masakala. So that was a lot to take on board. And I'd be lying if I said it didn't affect me. But part of the healing process, it was near the end of the tour. So we obviously had a service in Afghanistan at Bastion. And then a lot of the guys were coming back anyway, so we got to go to the actual funerals in the UK as well. But for me, because I was photographing the guys a lot over there, and then already I was thinking, there's something here, what can I do with it? That was more the Afghan National Police we were working with, because I was taking their portraits. But I think I put like a short video together for the regiment, which was also used for some of the training as well, to show sort of the how the lie of the land was, you know. But I think that helped me cope with the loss of the guys, because I was seeing the photographs a lot. I got to give the images to their family and stuff, so I saw that did good. But I, you know, that carried with me and some of the guys up until today. You know, every year we still all meet and walk up VW Valley, where there's a kern with a couple of plaques that we put there, and we all go up with the family every year. And my mate Steve, he's honourable enough to arrange and organise all of that for the guys. And then we pre-meet the night before in a bar and get absolutely shit-faced. So we always end up walking up VW Valley completely hungover. But yeah, I think those are the strongest points I took away from that.
Well, you know, working with the AMP, how did you feel, you know, during, like you said, already during a period that was kind of stressful with not being able to travel and not being able to, you know, do your normal kind of style of life? What was it like for you, you know, during that kind of that period where Afghanistan was on the news all the time? You know, you're seeing all these images on the TV.
It brought some stuff back, but I wasn't that upset, because deep down I always knew this was going to happen. And a lot of the guys did, you know. And obviously we got a few text messages from, you know, our commanding officer and stuff, just saying, look, guys, you know, it wasn't a waste of time. But I didn't feel that at the time. I wasn't like, oh, what a waste, you know. We were there to do a job at the time, and we did it to the best of our ability. We saved lives. We helped the locals, you know, and it's like any conflict. It's the politicians that fuck it up for everyone. Yeah. So I wasn't that bereaved by it, really. I was more annoyed because I thought at some point it'd be great if Afghanistan got to a stable point where I could revisit it and go and see Matakala and where we served and visit the opium poppy fields, you know, and walk around and see it. I felt sadder, really, for the women and young children of Afghanistan, because I knew that they would be reverted back to the lives before the Taliban were there.
I totally agree. I didn't feel like, what a waste. I just kind of felt like, more like, what a waste of human life and potential, rather than what a waste what we did on tour.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I mean, I got asked that question a lot. I mean, it did, but my girlfriend, she told me to go through my old images. So I got the hard drive out and I was going through them, and she put together this beautiful little kind of couple of minutes of just some random photos that I took on my Instagram. She posted it, and it brought back a lot of memories. And I hadn't seen some of these images for over 10 years. And I was like, wow, you know, it brought a lot back. I could even smell the terrain, you know, it was really weird. And I was thinking, God, you know, where are these people now? How are these people being affected by what's going on over there? But I think the first time I went out to Afghanistan, I think we had we didn't really have a lot of respect for the AMP or the Afghans. We found them very simple, obliging, but simple, and got very frustrated with them. And then I sort of went on R&R. And then when I went back, by that time, we'd sort of ingratiated ourselves with the way they were and their culture. You know, I think it's a British habit that we go over somewhere and go, right, you got to do this, and you got to walk like that, and you got to wear this, and you got to drink that. Do you know what I mean? And I think once we lost that, and then we were just like, okay, we're just going to roll with it and go with what the Afghans do, the tour became a lot easier for us to take on board, and we didn't have those frustrations.
Was there a lot of inshallah and going on?
Yeah, that was a lot. I mean, you know, the culturally it's hard for us, you know. I mean, like, you know, sort of man love Thursday and guys holding hands and, you know, guys. I mean, most of my portraits of the Afghans involved them wearing eyeliner and dyeing their hands with henna, you know, and I would tell everyone about sort of what I can't even call it homosexuality, but these guys shagging each other, you know. And you brought that information back to the UK, and for quite a while no one would believe me, or didn't want to believe me, you know, and they were like, oh no, that's punishable by death in Taliban culture. And I'm like, well, they're all doing it, you know. It's
I was gonna say, well, like, you might want to come and tell the lads that I just walked in on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and it's I think the culture and the people, I felt enriched by it, really. I didn't get back to the UK after my tour feeling frustrated or angry. I was, the only thing I was angry about was my mates had been killed, you know. And then when I went back and I was embedded as a photographer for the Sunday Times, that was in 2010. Again, that was strange because everything had changed so much. A lot of the weapon systems had changed. A lot of the tactics had changed, you know. So it was almost like going back to a different conflict zone.
Mm. Who were you embedded with?
I think it was the Mercians. Yeah, I switched around a little bit. But what was really bizarre was when I was out there, I remember photographing this guy. He was a sniper. And he was from Harlesden, which at the time I lived in Queen's Park, which is just up the road. And I remember watching the news one morning and they said, oh, this guy's been killed in Afghanistan. And his face popped up on the news. I couldn't believe it. And they said where his funeral was going to be that day. So I jumped on the motorbike and went down there, and I bumped into some of the guys that were there in Afghanistan. And I went up to his parents and said, look, I've got some photographs of your son, you know. So I handed them over to them. But yeah, that was quite a random thing.
You mentioned going back to, would you like, you know, is that something that you think about quite a lot, being able to go back to Afghanistan?
Yeah, no, I'd love to go back. Yeah, I mean, just to see it, to take it in again. You know, you can't spend nearly a year somewhere and not miss it in some way, shape or form. You know what I mean? I mean, it certainly wasn't the nightlife I was missing.
Mate, I would fucking love to go back and just be able to just, you know, not, I don't want to say hike, because, you know what I mean? Yeah. But basically just fucking, just walk around. Muscala, I thought was, you know, the countryside there was fucking gorgeous.
Oh, absolutely stunning, breathtaking, you know. And there was no traffic noise. There was hardly any planes going over. I mean, I've always explained to people, it's like, you know, we were on foot patrol going through fields and fields of opium poppies. You could just hear the trickling stream of where they're irrigating the fields. Beautiful sunny days. All right, it got crazily hot sort of after March time, but yeah, I mean, it was amazing. And you know, and there's pomegranate trees growing everywhere. It was quite breathtaking because it used to be pre the invasion from Russia. I mean, it was a very popular tourist route, you know, and it was a hippie trail. And I always said the one thing that will destroy the Taliban is tourism.
I mean, dude, I would fucking go. I would love to go about that. I mean, I really hope it happens. You know, I really hope.
No, me too.
Before I need fucking pushing in a wheelchair there everywhere, because I mean, because that'd be a bump. That would be a bumpy ride because the fucking ground there's not very smooth. But
that would be. I think it would be a shock to all of us that it wouldn't have changed at all as well.
Mate, no, that's exactly it. You know, it really won't have. And, you know, to just be able to sit there and actually fully relax without worrying about someone going to try and take your head off while you're sat there watching the sunset or something. I mean, I honestly can't think of many places I'd rather go. I really can't.
We were based in Muscala at the White House, and right. We used to sit up on the roof and watch the sunset, and then there'd be these snow-capped mountains in the background, and I'd be thinking, oh, I'd love to be snowboarding down those right now. Do you know what I mean? It's like that country has a lot to offer, and it's like Iran, you know. It's just, I think it's quite sad that the world can't go there and see it.
Yeah, I agree. And if it did, we probably, you know, obviously then there would be a lot less of a barrier to, you know, the more people that went, the more people would spread the word that everybody there isn't fucking evil, et cetera, et cetera. Mate, yeah. It's funny you should mention the White House. I was actually getting a drink in LA once. I got talking to these Marines, and one of, because I was up in Muscala as well. And it turned out he was one of the Marines, and he'd been living in the White House. And I was like, oh.
So, no fucking way.
Yeah, we just obviously got.
Did he say what year he was there?
Or? I think it would have been just after, I think 2010 probably, I think was when he was there, because I think he was just after us. Yeah.
Yeah, because we were there 2007, 2008. It was a proper shithole when we got there, mate. We spent like weeks clearing out. But again, going back to the reserve, the average age of the guys was late 20s, 30s. But a lot of the guys in their city life were either carpenters, builders, police, firemen. So, you know, electricians. So everyone sort of pulled on their skill set and really sort of made the place a lot better, you know. So it was quite interesting how we turned it around. And then I was at Satellite Station North, which was obviously just north of Mr. Carla as well.
It's almost like that's probably what it was like when people got drafted in the Second World War and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
People getting all these, you know, coming from all these different trades rather than, you know, I mean, obviously there's some reasons behind why, you know, the army does it, but when you pull in everyone at 16, 17 years old, it doesn't really bring any life experience in.
No, exactly. And I think that's key. I mean, artist rifles were formed in the First World War, made up of artists. And I think they were one of the most decorated regiments as well.
I think maybe it was a different brand of artists around back in those days, mate. I'm not sure really. I think we'd struggle to fill a battalion these days with... I mean, as much as I love my artistic friends, I'm not sure many of them would be up for a bayonet charge.
No, true. There's a lot of Guardian readers.
Mate, you know what? I actually fucking like the Guardian these days. I never thought. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying because it's one of the
you've hit that point in your life.
Well, I think it's because like they've always been like really critical of the state and of the government and stuff. And even though that I'm looking at it from maybe a different perspective of them, the facts that they're picking up on are the same. If you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I might disagree with their philosophy of why they're picking it up, but I'm like, no, this is also the hypocrisy that I've been picking up on. We're picking it up for different reasons, but they're one of the only articles that are actually fucking critical. One of the only things that are actually critical was most things now just fucking fluff pieces.
No, I know, clearly. I think a lot of people, like a lot of civilians think, like anyone in the military is sort of leans to be sort of right wing, you know, and pro conflict and stuff, and sort of, you know, when anything's kicking off in the news and, you know, my army chat on WhatsApp, we're all just being a bit like, yeah, what a bunch of twats, you know, it's just some leader in a room somewhere pressing buttons, you know, and it's the military that have to pay the price ultimately. I mean, Ukraine is a classic example, you know.
Mate, I totally agree. The most anti-war people I know are all veterans.
Yeah, because they've been there and done it. They've had their mates killed, they've got their boots dirty, and there's no bravado or ego. They know how real it is, and that makes a big difference, I think.
You know, like, having met the civvies, seen the kids,
yeah,
you know, and all that stuff, and you just... Because, you know, you realise, you know, I think a lot of time people see on the news, they think, oh, it's just this army and that army. Well, it's like, well, yeah, those are there, and the back... Because, you know, oh, mate, there's this guy, I kind of wanted to shake him, because he's a mate of mine, but he's American, and he was kind of pointing out, like, oh, wow, it's crazy to see this stuff in Ukraine when it's, like, fighting through people's, like, towns and homes. I'm like, bro, that compound in Afghanistan was someone's home. It didn't look like a home to you, but that was just as much of a home as that building in Ukraine is.
Yeah, no, so true.
So, mate, when it comes to your work then, is, you know, like, this... Is that, I don't want to put words in your mouth and say that it's an anti-war sentiment or something like that, but what is the kind of like message you want to get out through your work?
Like I said, a lot of the works are environmental. A lot of it really is what creates conflict, and then the environmental damage that's done, and then a lot of civil rights stuff. So I've done work with Human Rights, the organisation, so that took me out to Iraq. And then Spores of War, which is one of my better known pieces, that covers off what creates conflict. So as I said, I have these glass bullets made, 7.62 rounds, that I load into the mag, and the mag's cut out so you can see them. And then within the bullets, there's commodities and symbolic fillings that denote the narrative of the art piece. So Spores of War, for instance, the bullets are full of earth to represent fighting for land, religious symbols, fighting over religion, blood for retribution, gold, diamonds, cocaine. And I even brought back some opium poppy seeds from Afghanistan to put in the bullets as well. So, the symbolism of the artworks tend to be around those subject matters, because obviously environment and poaching and what's going on in Africa at the moment with all the poachers is sort of very close to my own heart.
So the environmental one, mate, that is a really interesting point, because it's something I think is really totally overlooked. When did you start thinking about that?
It's one of the first artworks I made. So that's sort of going back to 2013. Yeah. So I sort of, the environment and how it is affected by conflict and just the human footprint has sort of always bothered me, really, even since I was a teenager. And it's only really now where people talk about it and it's fashionable to talk about it, you know, which I think is really sad, because up until that point, they're doing so much damage. And what's not really mentioned is the actual harm that we have done to the planet and sort of the crisis levels we're at, you know. And I think people, as humans, have a bad habit of sort of painting over stuff like that, whitewashing over the real problems, because they don't want it to be depressing, you know. They don't want to talk about it too much. You know, it's that kind of look at the world through rose-tinted glasses sort of vibe. But I think it's something, I mean, it's good now that it's become a constant subject matter, and it's something that we all play a part in. But again, it's like all these issues, it's at the governmental level where only proper big changes can be made, you know. I was doing some work with Greenpeace, and we were talking about all the plastic waste and stuff. And they're saying now that most humans hold up to a credit card's worth of plastic microfibers within your bloodstream.
Mate, I saw that movie. What's that movie called? That Dark Water. Do you know which movie I'm all about with Mark Ruffalo? Because that was about, So I think the company was like Monsanto or one of those kind of companies.
Basically,
the movie's based on a true story. It's about this plant, and that all their stuff was going into the water from Teflon, and it was killing everyone off in this town with fucking cancers and stuff from the plastics. And that it was fucking mental, mate.
Fucking crazy.
And it basically had some statistics, the fact that all of us pretty much in the world now have got Teflon inside of us.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. I mean, and scary at the same time, you know, and it's just sort of, I think we're just at the precipice now of like, is this reversible, you know? And then you've got like the likes of China that are just like catapulting into the world of creating more stuff and more pollution, and we're trying to pull back, you know. And I mean, not that it's their fault, but it's it is very scary. And like, you know, you start disliking humans as a whole.
I mean, we are extremely flawed, mate, but you know, like, yeah, it's a tough one, mate, because it's one of those ones as well. It's like we all kind of contribute to it. It's all to degrees for sure, but I mean, there's nobody really who's got totally clean hands in it. And you know, unwittingly or I mean, look, I know with plastics are bad. Do I still use plastics? Yes. So you know,
I mean, I totally agree with you, but what I try and break down on is the consumption. You know, like if I have to buy a bottle of plastic, a bottle of water, and it's in a plastic bowl, I'll kind of use that plastic bottle and refill it, you know, for a good few weeks before it dies or I bin it, you know. And I mean, especially in America, the consumption is just insane. You know, it's just the plastic fucking forks and plastic straws and stirrers for your Starbucks. And it's just, we have sort of slipped into this world of convenience and yeah, you know, capitalism, and you know, we're sort of always eating, and you know, and I think it's just we just have to sort of cut back on all of that. Supermarkets are sort of a plain example of like individually wrapping stuff in plastic bags because they want to sell 4 lemons when you can just pick a lemon and stick it in a brown paper bag. You know, it's sort of,
mate, it's fucking wrapping stuff of fucking fruit that already has like its own natural rapping is what fucking that one does really grip my shit.
Oh no, it winds me up, mate. It winds me up, and you know, and they're trying to pull supermarkets out on it, and you're just like, you know, I mean, the thing is, you go into your local supermarket, right, and you see that on a shelf, but like times that by 1,000, and then times that by 365 days, and that's one supermarket. You know, it's just like it's ridiculous, and I think that's the first point of call that we need to cut down on is just on mere consumption, you know.
And everyone should stop using condoms. That's my new thing with chicks now, mate. It's like, look, I've got to think about the environment. Can't use condoms, sorry.
Yeah, does that mean you're basically going to be reusing
condoms? All right, maybe not. Maybe I need to rethink this one. So, mate, what is it you've kind of got going on the next year that you're most excited about?
Well, the continuation of Kalash 47, which is the NFT project that I did, and is still ongoing. It has a community on Discord. So we sort of talk, and I'll be bringing out new NFTs that I'll be incorporating into that. Working on a grenade NFT project, and then need to pick up again this anti-poaching project that I was doing in Africa, where I'm looking at ex-servicemen that have gone over to Africa, and they're utilizing their skills to train the wardens over there and fight the poachers, which I find very fascinating. And I think as well, that kind of puts me in touch with those like-minded people, which I enjoy being around. And then I'm in end of May, I'm getting married. So that's a big deal. And then you're just continuing with the artworks. You know, I've got a lot of orders for clients and back orders. And like I said, you know, sort of you treat it like a business. So you sort of have to continue growing and thinking up new things and thinking outside the box, really, you know, so you don't go stale.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great position to be in as well, to have work ahead of, you know, like to have a backlog of work as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And every day I get up and I thank myself and thank my lucky stars for that, you know. But I mean, I haven't got to anywhere without hard graft and grind and some sleepless nights and a very empty bank account, you know. So, but yeah, you know, if you pursue it and you really believe in yourself, then you can get there. I mean, I know it sounds a bit cheesy, but it's true, you know. This is probably the third year out of 8 or 9 years where I've had a consistency of work, and I've got stuff happening and future exhibitions and galleries that want my work. And that it's a good feeling, because you want to build on that and make it stronger, you know, and not kind of rest on your laurels and lose that momentum.
So what you're saying is you're an overnight success after 9 years of work.
I wouldn't even say that, yeah. Well, if I ever say I'm an overnight success, then I'm a twat.
So, mate, where can people find you online? Where can they find your work, the NFTs, all that kind of stuff? I mean, if you've got a website, if you want to give us a website and your Instagram, and I'll link everything up in the show notes so people can just click through.
Yeah, so the easiest way to get through to everything is to go on my website, and that's www.brand, which is B-R-A-N, Bravo Romeo Alpha November, and then Simonson, which is S-Y-M-O-N-D-S-O-N, .com, brandsimonson.com. And then that links through to my Instagram, which is also Brand Simonson. There's a link to the Kalash 47 project and the NFTs, which tells you all about it, and you get some visuals and see what they look like. And then I sort of update stuff on Instagram of what I'm doing and that.
Yeah, and I'll link everything up in the show notes, and definitely recommend.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Thank you.
Absolutely. And when I'm...
And obviously as well, sorry to interrupt, obviously as well, if there's any... Because I've got a thing called Battle Boutique, which is I sell prints of the artworks and smaller art pieces on there. And I've always said, you know, if anyone's out there that likes the work that's ex-military, just hit me up. And if I can send them something extra or give them a discount, I'll be happy to.
Well, I know one of those people. He's on the phone at the moment. I have been perusing, mate, because I'm a fan. So I was taking a look on there later. So we'll have a chat.
Oh no, thank you. Well, no, just hit me up and I'll sort you out, mate.
Nice one. See, this is the whole reason I got you on here, mate. So seduce you into a discount.
that's a lot of time dedicated for a discount. Mate, I almost feel like fucking giving you one.
As long as it's more than a few quid, mate. Yeah, but no, thanks so much for coming on today, mate. I fucking love to see people doing different things. Like, I'm sure you're the same way. I hate this thing of like, oh, veterans broken, veterans go and lie under a bridge and die kind of fucking thing. It's great to see you out there,
yeah,
doing stuff, mate.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And it's you'd be surprised how many veterans are out there making artwork. You know, I think it would make a good exhibition, getting a lot of ex-military to sort of do a collaborative art show at some point. But I hear you on that one. And I think it's good. You know, I see Jason Fox doing a lot of stuff for ex-veterans and stuff. And I think it's good that there's that vibe and energy out there, because it never used to be like that. And I think it's important. If I'm ever out and I meet someone, you know, an old brother in arms, I'll always like take more interest and listen to them and see if I can help them out at all. Whether I'm in a position to help them, I don't know, but I think it's good that we sort of, you know, look out for each other.
Well, mate, I totally agree. And I think you will have helped some people out today, putting them in. Like, there's sometimes people need, don't want to say that they need to be given the permission to succeed, because they don't. But when you've come from maybe a community, especially, like, let's be honest, when you're in the infantry, like, or if you're in the army and you're living in the lines, there's probably not that many people sitting around talking about art. So someone listening right now might be thinking, well, I want to go into this different career. It doesn't need to be art, but something that's different outside the normal. And they need to know that you can do it.
No, absolutely. I mean, I didn't touch on it. I was going to mention it, but like, because obviously I was in the reserves, so I was holding down a normal job in photography while I was doing all my training. But when obviously I went away and I had the PDT, the pre-deployment training, then I was 110% in. And then when I got back from Afghanistan and I was thrown back into Civvy Street, mate, I didn't know if I was having a shit or a haircut. I was lost for a couple of months. And I remember thinking, what must it be like for the guys that have been doing 5-10 year stretches full time? You know, it's a tough bridge to cross, but I think if you take the ethos of what you learn in the military and apply it to anything in Civvy Street, mate, you're 10 steps ahead immediately.
Yeah, 100%, mate. Totally agree. Well, thanks for going on, mate. Really appreciate it. And like I said, everyone go and check out Brown's work. You won't be disappointed. Sport Velo Veteran. And yeah, thanks so much for your time, bro. Cheers.
That's been a real pleasure, mate. Real pleasure.
A dream to all of us, a dream that we'd all die for. A reason for us all to live and something we could fight for. I might just help a man up to his feet or hold a newborn. But no matter what I do, my hands remembering my rifle.